Oh man.
All right, here comes another podcast here.
We're still laughing at this cover.
What, you laughing at my face on there?
Yeah, the cover on
the pop filters.
The pop filter.
Snoopy Clark in the house roasting my podcast setup. This man rolled up and I'm supposed to be doing a podcast and he pulls out a GoPro and he's streaming it to his own phone. I'm like, how are you going to out technical me in my own podcast right here?
It's not going nowhere. It's not live, man.
I couldn't even get out the gate. Put it on Periscope. I don't care. That's good. That'd be sweet. So
you want to go on Periscope?
Maybe. I don't know.
I'm not going to do that to you, man. You dress like you're comfortable at home.
Dude, I don't care. You can look at me like that. I ain't worried about it. That's how I dress anyway.
You're right.
I know, dude. I don't care. I mean, sometimes if I'm going somewhere and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to look like a Nashville Outcast if I wear shorts, basketball shorts with paint on them.
So, yeah, you do a Nashville thing and put on
all black. Yes, dude. I go to the safe colors, bro.
The safe colors.
The solid darks with not a lot going on. You know, like some black jeans and like a dark gray shirt. That's my home.
Dark denim jeans with a black shirt.
Yeah, and like a hat turned to the side, to the back. Mm-hmm. I'm good. So anyway, this is the late night edition of the Tall Tales of Taylor Jones podcast. Mr. Snoopy Clark, well, you had a rehearsal till 8 or what was going on?
Yeah, the last week or 2 weeks, we actually get to skip next week, but I've been in rehearsals for a developing artist named Gabriella. Just getting her used and accustomed to just sort of live band performance. So we've been Monday through Thursday at SIR rehearsing from 12 to 8. So really long days.
Long days, dude. Plucking them bass strings.
Plucking bass strings. Got a little key bass going.
Oh, really?
Little machine action.
Okay. Well, cool, man. So
more than what a bass player probably needs to have set up.
Oh, okay. And a little GoPro camera.
And a little GoPro camera recording
right
rehearsals.
There. Yeah. I need to get me one of them things, man. That thing was sharp. He showed me a picture of his phone. And there we were sitting there. I said, dang, I didn't know. I should have put on some jeans or something.
Put on your Nashville swag.
Yeah, for sure. Memphis, Tennessee. That's where you're born and raised, right?
Born and raised. Memphis, Tennessee. That's home.
So how long you been here?
August will make it. Actually, the end of this month makes it 7 years.
Dang, bro.
7 years.
7 years. So
that's a good number, 7.
Yeah, man, there's a lot that can happen in 7 years playing in this crazy town, ain't it? So what? Now, you and Terrence, so for everybody who don't know, Snoop and Terrence are brothers. Terrence Clark was on here a couple months ago. And he plays drums, so naturally we, you know, nerded out pretty good about drum things and had a good talk. But I actually met you. I want to talk about how I met you because it was pretty interesting. I was trying to get some in-ears made from somewhere, and somehow I ended up getting a referral to Eau Claire in-ears from the guys at church. So like Luke and John Reddick and all of them guys. And they're like, yeah, you should check this company out. And so I went to the website, and is that what I did? I think that's what I did. I think I just was like, hey, how does this work or whatever? And then on the other end of that was you somehow. And when we got to talking, we figured out that you were Terrence's brother. And I was like, oh, man, that's crazy because I had just met Terrence at the time like a couple months before that. And so it's like my first time meeting you, we were sticking lights on my ears and trying to get in-ears made. And then my ear was messed up.
I just
up.
Thought about it. It took us like 5 appointments to get.
My ear was messed up, man. I had this one janky ear that wouldn't get right. No, I didn't tell you this. Did I tell you the story about how after you said, well, you need to go to your flesh, I went and got a flesh, paid the lady $100, and it didn't even work.
And she didn't do it. And then you bought the deep rocks that I told you about.
Yeah, so I dropped $100 on her, and She said, well, I can only do so much of it. She did 3 rounds of it, and it still couldn't get it out. It was so deep off in the bottom of my ear, blocked up. So I was like, oh, my gosh. I was so mad about that $100, Snoop. It wasn't even funny. So then you said, go buy, what was it?
D-Brocks.
So D-Brocks. You put this stuff in your ear and stick a cotton in your ear and then just walk around for about an hour and do that for about 5 days. And that's how you clean your ear out for the long run. So where you can get your ears made. Because you can't get your ears made when you got a blockage at the bottom. Finally, yeah. I was so embarrassed, though. I was like, this is them became a whole week and a half's ordeal and 4 or 5 appointments over to the house. So, yeah, that's how we met. We met under awkward circumstances.
That is hilarious. I forgot that we had to get you in like 3 times before
I know
we got it done.
And I was like in and out of town at the time, too. So it would be like a week gone, another week gone, another week not having in ears either. So, but we got them now. Praise the Lord. They're good. I got them wearing in right now so I can hear the playback of this thing, make sure the mic's still working. So let's talk about you and Terrence growing up together, and how'd you guys ever start playing music?
I haven't even heard his podcast to know how much he told you. That's the interesting part.
That's going to make it good. We're going to find out if it's the truth
or not. If it's
the
truth.
Yeah.
Part of my personal story is I was sort of the confused one growing up, trying to figure out what I wanted to play. Of course, we grew up in a very musical family. Our grandfather, when he was younger, was part of a quartet group, lead singer, played guitar. Our dad is an amazing pianist and organist. So we grew up just around music and sort of a lot of the legacy that they left us, which I won't dig into today, but they pretty much set a very high standard as far as what just that stewardship and integrity of being a great musician looks like. So growing up, like any kid, I wanted to be like my dad. So I actually started out trying to play keyboard. And what was hilarious is I had this little small, it was a real keyboard. But I would literally set it on the banister right by the organ and sit on his bench with him every Sunday and, like, try to play with him, even though my keyboard was not plugged up to anything. It was, like, just a little speaker where I could hear it sitting beside him. And then he actually put us in – actually, both my brother and I took piano lessons growing up. And for some reason, just the piano lessons just didn't really grab me or pull me in, probably because I was a – ADD little kid and really hyperactive. But I left piano because I just really didn't like it and decided that I wanted to try to be a drummer. That didn't work too well because if you know my brother, you would know that there was no way I was going to be better than he was.
So he smoked you on the drums?
I mean, that there was no way for him not to. He was playing at 2.
Really?
And I left drums and sort of shifted over to, like, playing a little percussion, which I actually enjoy percussion. It sort of gave me the opportunity to do some stuff, you know, beside my brother. And the story sort of goes, I had a older cousin, his name was Altonio Miller, who found a miniature scale guitar at a pawn shop that had 4 strings on it. And he gave it to my dad, and my dad literally gave it to me one day and said, "Here, you're about to be still and learn this." So it sort of forced me to sort of focus on one thing. And, of course, growing up, that was probably about 5th grade when he gave me that guitar. And as a kid, you don't really realize the difference between – when you see a guitar, you see a guitar. You don't really know that the electric and the bass are 2 completely different things. And playing at church, it just became that thing that my dad had a lot of friends and some of my cousins would come, older cousins, and they would play the bass for Sunday services and things like that. And I slowly started to learn the difference between, like, what the two were. Even sonically, just looking at it and trying to figure out, man, what are they doing? I sort of want to be doing that. And around maybe middle school or, like, the end of middle school, beginning of high school, we started a jazz band, a gospel jazz band. It was me on guitar, my brother on drums, a cousin of ours named Tim Clark playing keyboard, good friend of the family, Kenneth Hollins on saxophone, and our godbrother, Kendrick Banger, on bass. And there was a, what was the name of that club? There was a gospel jazz club in Memphis called Shabak, if I'm correct. But yeah, we were pretty much the house band for that club, and our band, actually, interestingly enough, we decided to sort of play off of the name of the the club and decided to name our band Zamar, which of course means a high praise, if anybody doesn't know that.
I didn't know that. I mean, I was going to ask, but...
Oh, actually, you know what? I may sound real stupid because I may be confused on the two.
Fact check.
Fact check.
The old Google fact check. So, and then in a minute, you're going to have to tell me what gospel jazz is, too, because I ain't trying to take that for granted.
You said what gospel jazz is?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Kirk Whalum?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've met him a couple times.
It would be like along the lines of some of his projects that he's released, like the Gospel According to Jazz, sort of that kind of stuff.
You know, he used to be an elder at Strong Tower?
No, I didn't know that.
Back in the day, yeah, he was.
Memphis, man.
Sure was, man.
Yeah, he's by far one of the greatest saxophone players ever.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Zamar means, it says short definition, praises. It's Hebrew.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, the club was named after a Hebrew, you know, term, and we decided to name the band after a Hebrew term. And our godbrother actually at one point transitioned out of the band. And, of course, you know, guitar is okay, but it's not that needed in any band.
Okay, that's a big statement.
I know, I'm being real. Just
that's a real big, I can't just go along with that one.
You know, I got to, you know, it's about the rhythm section, man. We carry it.
Okay, no, I can deal with that.
You can deal with that.
I can deal with that.
I love guitars. They're great. It just wasn't my thing.
He's just like, we really don't need it. I mean,
well, that's what they told me. That's what they told me. They were like, well, I mean, we really don't need guitar. So, you know, here goes a bass. And Kenny Hollins actually had a bass, 4-string bass that he brought, gave it to me. And he was like, hey, man, here you go. So literally just in the process of being in the band, I had the chance to sort of jump from just guitar to bass just all out of, you know, sort of practical need. And from day one, it felt right, you know.
Right.
Picked
felt
it
like
up
home.
And it felt like home. It was one of those, what in the world have I been doing for as long as I've been trying to figure out what I should be doing? So it was a great opportunity to step into that. And I've actually still got that bass. It was like a no-name jammer. J-A-M-E-R.
So tell me about this, because you told me one time that you ain't ever spent over $100 on a bass. Is that true?
I've been extremely blessed just in the process of being able to find some of the gear that I've gotten, and even in the sponsorships that I've been given in the time that I've been doing this. The first bass, of course, he gave me that bass. The next bass I was given was a birthday gift from my parents. It was a 5-string Fender. And I've actually still got all these basses, which is hilarious. So I was on the 5-string for a long time. Had an older cousin that played bass, and he sort of used to pick at me. And he was like, man, you're not a real bass player. You don't play a 4-string. He said, you got that 5-string. You're real dependent.
Real dependent.
You're real dependent on that 5-string. So he actually had a 4-string Warwick rock bass, which is to this day like one of my brother's favorite basses that I've got. And he sold that to me for $200. After that, I lucked out and got a 4-string Fender fretless jazz from somebody for $200. So, yeah, I've sort of never had to pay more than that for, like, a bass.
That's good stuff right there. That's frugal.
Yeah.
There's a difference between frugal and cheap.
Now, I will say the last bass that I purchased was definitely probably the biggest purchase I've done on a bass. And, I mean, it was still through a sponsorship. It's a local guy named Chopper Anderson. He makes some amazing basses called Alien Audio basses. And I started sort of last year. I just made a decision, you know, hitting 30 last year, 31 this year. I decided starting last year that every year I'm going to get myself a really good gift. So last year was
okay.
Last year was a big music investment. And then this year it was the bass. So that bass probably equaled the portable studio setup I bought last
year. Dang,
bro.
I hear that.
You know, so it's, I mean, and even with that, it was still, I mean, he still blessed me just out of the relationship with him with an amazing deal. But yeah, I mean, it's been such a blessing to sort of just be an average Joe that I, or at least I would consider myself an average Joe. I mean, I know some amazing musicians that are definitely well known, and you know, I feel like I'm sort of just the guy that plays my part. You know, I'm a bassist. I play in bands, and that's about it. I wouldn't say I'm a virtuoso or anything. I don't really have any chops.
Shoot. Better quit that. You better quit that.
So
shoot, you're in the pocket. That's all that matters.
That's all that matters. I play songs.
Yeah.
I just play the songs. And that was a big thing that our dad sort of instilled in us growing up as well. You know, it was always a matter of, at the end of the day, it's cool to have the knowledge and know how to do a lot of the other stuff, but it's really good just to know how to play the songs, and not just to play the songs, but how to communicate with other members of a band. Because, of course, music is a language, you know, it's dialogue. You know? And I think to this day, that's probably why it's so difficult to, and then I've sort of been spoiled. I mean, you know my brother, you know Terrence, so being a bass player and playing with a brother who's a drummer, you know, there's really no, we've got both an on stage and an off stage connection that's sort of really hard to describe, you know. And when you speak and you can communicate that language to somebody without even thinking twice about it and have just those moments, it makes it, you really understand it differently.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are, it's a lot of fun to watch you guys play together, you know. And so, you figure out that you're going to be the bass player, and then what did Terrence do? Is he like, all right?
He didn't really say much then, but over the process of playing bass, we've had a very interesting relationship.
Like in what kind of way?
We've had some physical fish thrown, but you know, that's also brothers.
You know,
one getting mad at the other for making mistakes, or one getting mad at the other one for addressing or actually saying that the other one made mistakes, even if we felt like we didn't. It's been some fisticuffs, some tough love. But you know, like I said, it's definitely made me better and helped me grow. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, it's helped him grow as well.
Yeah.
So it's been a great journey, man. It's really been great. There is this really one funny story, and you'll like this.
Sure, I will.
So we were at church, and this is after I've been playing bass for a while. Now, take into account, I didn't always play bass at church. So there were a lot of songs that were normal songs that we did at church all the time growing up that my brother just assumed I was supposed to know on bass. So the way the church is set up, our dad is on the organ in this one side of the across from the pulpit. And the drums and the bass are on the opposite side of the pulpit. So we're playing this song. And, man, I always hate when I do that. Terrence addressed that on one podcast I did where I always say,
Oh.
And he's probably going to say the same thing about this because, you know, he's my older brother. So quit, he has doing to critique it, me.
My thing, I say like too much.
Like, that's your word? Is mine.
Like.
It's like I'm always thinking. So we were playing the song, and I sort of started making some mistakes and making some flubs. And this is hilarious. We had an older cousin who watched the whole thing from out in the congregation and like laughed the whole time. At the end of the song, we finished the song, and Terrence stands up off the drums in my face. And like, he's like, bro, why are you messing up, man? You're supposed to know the song. And I'm looking at him like, bro, sit down, bro, sit down. And the whole time our dad is looking at both of us across the way like, if y'all don't stop. And this is during, so it was hilarious.
Y'all finna scrap on the church.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fisticuff moment, but not in the church, outside the church. But it was a funny moment. You know, it was one of those like, yep, we're brothers.
Yep.
You know.
And he didn't know the song.
And I didn't know the song, apparently. You know, and I'm like, I never played that one. As much as we've sang it, I've never played that one. I don't know the song. He'll probably still argue to this day that I knew the song.
I wish he was here for that. He's like, no, he's supposed to know the song.
He knew the song. And you know he'll say it.
Yeah.
He's like, no, he knew the song. He played that song. I know he played that song. No, I didn't know the song. It's on tape. I didn't know the song.
It's on tape. Oh, my goodness.
I heard it, and I followed it as best as I could. But so, there was some bad notes in there, you know.
Shoot, we've all done it. Take it to the bridge. Oh, the chorus? Okay.
Take it to the bridge, the chorus.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'll be right there on that chorus. Bridge? Oh, you said, you know, Bridge.
And it definitely, there was another band that he played with for a couple of years, and some of my biggest growth came from the fact that having a brother who was doing a lot of stuff around town and being a younger brother playing bass and looking at him like, hey, man, you know, you're going to give me some work? You know, you're going to call me on a gig? And I mean, he never said it, but I can tell, like, there was always that you're not ready yet, mm-hmm. you know, and I can really respect a lot of those moments, because a lot of the moments where I sat back and I was like, man, the bass player for that gig, that's normally the bass player, he can't do the gig, and for some reason I'm not getting the call, you know, and I would ask him, like, man, like, you know, why didn't they call me, you know, and he would never really just say it straightforward, but it definitely pushed me just in my personal time and to, like, want to get better and to push to get better, to be like, man, I need to be that call, so when the normal bass player can't do it, you know, I'm the one that they call.
So what's the secret to that? I mean, you're now that you're 31 or whatever you told me, 30, 31, like, what is your, what's some of your things that you do to now make sure that people have an enjoyable experience when they call, when they hire you for something, to get a call back?
One of the biggest things that I've learned in the time of doing this is, see, there I go, I need to get that out.
Quit it. Stop.
One of the biggest things that I've learned is you have to, and I guess it's one of the things our dad always said, is when you play a gig to where when you're not on the gig, you're missed.
Ah.
So any gig that I walk into, I always try to approach it. I mean, because I'm not any other player. You know, there's some amazing players. There's some great guys who I wouldn't necessarily want to come behind playing a gig. But at the end of the day, there's something that they have that I don't have. And I've learned in also building that confidence of the player that I am, that there's a lot that I have to offer that other people don't have as well. So it's become one of those things of every gig that I step on, just sort of leaving that stamp of like, hey, I'm here. This is me. Make it feel great, play the music, put myself into it, and, you know, just really give everything I've got to where when I'm not there, you know that I'm not there.
Okay, I see that. That's a great way to look at it.
Yeah.
I never heard nobody say it like that. That's good stuff, man. So what was, like, I know you played with a lot of artists, but what was, like, the first gig that you got that you was, like, really legit, and you were like, okay, this one is cool? Or this has a lot of potential for career growth or whatever it is. First bus gig, something along those lines.
Well, the first gig that sort of started the CCM or the Contemporary Christian Market journey was in 2004. We were playing with a group called Brothers Keeper that's no longer around. And they were based out of Memphis. Two of the guys actually are the guys who started Camp Electric that happens in town.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Gabe and
John.
Yeah. So we played with them. And that was sort of our first gig, which actually happened out of Memphis, which was pretty awesome, too. But it was cool. We got to do, like, a cruise boat, and that was when Rachel Lampo was doing her thing, and Tate was a solo artist. And
wow, yeah.
Super Chick were going strong.
Yep.
Some great bands.
I remember. That's my youth group days.
That's my youth group days. So, I mean, that was probably one of my biggest moments, because it really just sort of gave me the opportunity to get out of Memphis and do some festivals. And actually, that was around the time that we actually did a festival that was called En Fuego. And we got to meet Toby and his guys back in 2004 for the first time. So that was a great experience. They sort of became really good friends at that point.
So, I mean, that must have came full circle this year since you did some
really
shows.
Full circle.
So how was that for you?
How was what?
Ended up with Toby for a little while. Are you still with him or no? Or what's?
Oh, well, I knew what you were saying, but okay. I don't think anybody else knows
what the full
circle was.
My bad. It's late, y'all. We're working on it. It's going to be in a comment. It's going to be in the description below. Who and all these people that you done played with? So
that
I'm
means
taking
I gotta send
granted.
You a list.
Yeah, send me a long list. No, send me. I'll just. Yeah, send me a list. I'll pick my favorite ones.
Well, it did it came full circle, just sort of spinning off of what you asked. It came full circle this year because I was actually blessed to get called by Toby's management to fill in for Todd on Hits Deep. So it was more of just like a fill-in thing. Just like last minute, Todd had some stuff and couldn't go out. And when I spoke with the manager, and even when I spoke to Dave Wyatt, who's Toby's music director, and we had a conversation, I think when they all sat down and sort of talked about what calls to make, I don't think there was any other calls or names that came up. So it definitely, it was very humbling. Like you said, it was really full circle to have known these guys for, I mean, at this point, it's 2016, so that's 12 years. I mean, yeah, Toby's been doing it 15. And it's an opportunity that I never expected, or a call I never expected I would have gotten. Only because as long as I've known those guys for, you know, the 12 odd years, I've never seen Toby without Diversity. So just to be, first off, to be thought about enough to be considered the only call to make, like I said, was very humbling. And in a lot of ways, it let me know that along the journey of what I've been doing and what I've been creating, that I've been doing something right. You know,
of course,
I think
yeah.
we all as musicians and artists go through highs and lows. And I think a lot, especially having a lot of artist friends, it seems like we tend to find ourselves in a lot of lows. You know, our, what we do is, it's not easy. It's real easy to clock into a job and work 8 hours a day and be like, oh, you know, bills are paid every month, or I got a check every 2 weeks. And I think there's definitely a different kind of faith that comes along. And, you know, some months we have really busy months and money's good, and other months it's like, okay, so what am I going to do this month?
Mow some grass.
Mow some grass. Let me get into graphic design. Let me be a photographer. Let me go bus tables at a restaurant for, you know, or Starbucks. That's an infamous one.
Yeah.
For artists and musicians.
Yeah, for sure.
Starbucks is an infamous one.
Why are people so mean to the Starbucks employees, though?
I don't know. I don't really do
like
Starbucks.
Like customers. I don't either, but everybody I know that works there is like, dude, human beings.
Yeah.
When they need coffee, they're equal.
Yeah.
I don't get it. That's how you know that caffeine is real. It's a drug.
Caffeine is a drug.
It is. People are cutting a promo on you for 7 a.m. in the morning.
That experience was amazing, though, man. Just to, I mean, as far as the pop side of the contemporary Christian market, in my opinion, and somebody may want to argue with me, I don't feel like it gets any bigger than Toby. So it was definitely, I don't really know how to describe really what that felt like. You know, to be in Nashville for 7 years, and I mean, I've sort of hopped around the market. Me and my brother first played and toured with B. Reif, amazing artist.
Friend of the show?
You said what?
He did our show too.
Oh, he did?
My podcast, yeah.
Oh. Was he one of the 15 today?
No, he was up about a month ago.
Oh, did you take him down?
No, they're still up there.
Okay, I need to go find him.
Yeah, he's on there.
I need to go listen to him.
Yeah.
He was the first guy. Following him, I spent a lot of time on the road with Mr. Talkbox. I've had some scattered shows. And this was another amazing experience. It was great to be able to leave and experience out of the country for the first time with my brother. And we both got to do that for the first time with Nicole C. Mullen, and we got to go to Burundi.
Really? I didn't know you played with her.
Yeah.
Was Steph the road manager back then?
Yeah, she was. That's when we met Mama Fitzgerald.
Oh, yeah.
And that's when we got adopted into the family. That's when we got adopted into the family.
Yeah, she'll keep everybody in line, boy.
So, yeah, that was, and to me, those are things that I haven't been able to really trade either. Just to be able to say that a lot of my first experiences and the great moments that I've had, I've been able to share with my brother.
I hear that. I've received that. I've done that a lot, too, so I know what you mean. It's nice to have that experience with somebody that knows you really, really well, and they know how much you want it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't know, you're never alone in that case, which on the road you can really be alone.
Yeah.
For sure.
Surrounded by people and still alone.
Oh, yeah. It's the weirdest thing, but So that's like arenas, right, with Toby?
Yeah. So it was Hits Deep, which is Toby's tour.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was actually more West Coast.
Okay.
So it was about 2.5 months. I think the largest crowd that, and it's a lot different playing with some of the other artists that I played for, being in like a opening slot or like in the middle of the night, because you realize like there's still people showing up to the arena or still like giving their tickets so they can get in. So it's extremely breathtaking to be like the, with the headlining artist of the night and like see a room full of 13, 14,000 people and just what that experience looks like. And it was crazy. And it was, the experience was really scary in the sense that I literally got a call. There we go. I'm always thinking out loud, apparently. I got a call a week before the tour was supposed to leave. They called me the weekend before and they said, we've got 1 day for rehearsal, which was a 10, maybe 12 hour day. And we had some family emergencies come up, a family loss earlier that week. So I got the call during a video shoot that me and my brother were doing for an indie artist. Went home that Sunday. Or no, actually pulled into town that Tuesday. Went straight to a wake for a family member we lost. Pulled back into Nashville Wednesday. I actually got the music for Toby driving home to Memphis, which means I never got to sit with it.
Oh, my goodness.
So I made a playlist while I was in Memphis. After the funeral Wednesday, drove back home and spent 4 hours learning 18 songs.
Oh, my goodness.
To go into rehearsal the next day for 10 hours and run the whole show. And it was actually a fun experience in the sense that, of course, like I said, because I pop around with so many artists, I'm sort of used to sort of stretching those muscles and having to learn songs and learn materials and doing one-offs with random artists. So I would confidently say I came into rehearsal and a lot of the guys, even in rehearsal, were like, man, we don't see how you learn all of that stuff literally in like a night. You know, there were maybe 2 songs when rehearsal ended where I was like, okay, I need to go home and actually like sit down with that. And then on top of that, if you've seen Toby's show, of course, you know, it's like not just the music that you have to worry about, but it's like, man, I've got to figure out choreo and staging. Mm. There's like 18 people on stage. I mean, not literally, but a ton of people on stage. So it's like blocking. And so it was a lot to take in. But I would say, quit umming, man. I'm talking out loud, people. I would say it was definitely a great experience, and it sort of created that same thing that I said, where you go in on a gig and you sort of leave that stamp where at the end of the day, they remember sort of what you did and who you are.
So what's your approach to learning songs like that in a hurry? Like, how do you do it? Are you a chart guy or are you a listen to it guy or like what's.
It really depends on the gig. Growing up, I learned mostly by ear. So if I listen to something enough, as a bass player, a lot of bass players learn bass lines when they learn songs. One of my favorite bass players growing up was Jaco. And Jaco was more of a melodic bass player. And he always approached songs more from the melody. So for me, like I said, I made that playlist before I was coming back to Nashville. And I nonstop before I sat down with the songs, just played the songs, listened to them. So once those melodies got in my head, it was a lot easier to hear where the song was going, what the song was doing. So once I got home to sit down with him, because I knew where he was melodically, it was easier to be able to sit down and be like, okay, now I can just pick up the bass and just follow where the songs are because I'm familiar with just that melody. So in that situation, because there was such a time crunch, I sort of more or less just sort of tried to commit it to memory, which I also, especially in getting older, I try to make sure I stick to doing that because I don't want to get to the point to where just my memory isn't being stretched enough and I'm sort of relying on other things. But there have been situations where I'm learning music, and the reality is, even when you're charting, which I do mostly numbers chart, I know how to read sheet music, but a lot of the technical theory side for me, I didn't go to school, didn't study that stuff. actually went to school for a degree that I don't use in something that is far from the music industry.
But you got a degree, though?
But I got a degree.
Okay.
Associates in Computer Drafting and Design. Really
oh
random.
Lord.
Really random. But, yeah, in doing, like, the charts and stuff, even when you're writing charts, you're memorizing the music. And that's a plus, too. So there are some gigs. I did one gig probably about 2 months ago with a local guy named Chris Hatfield. And we played the hard rock. And there was a 30-song set list. And the first set was majority country covers. And half of those songs I did not know. So it was definitely a chart moment. And the difficult thing with a gig like that is, over time, those songs started to sound the same.
Oh, well.
So it was almost no way to be like, okay, let me commit this to memory, because I would start playing one song and in my head start hearing the melody of another one because they're so similar, to where I was like, I definitely need a chart to make sure I'm following these songs, right?
Oh, yeah. The one about the truck. Oh.
The one about the truck.
There's 3-4 of them like that. I hear that, man. So it just, because Terrence was telling me he's not like big on charts.
Yeah.
You know?
I think both of us just, plus it, you
like
enjoy
them.
The music a lot more when you spend
yes.
the time learning it. You know, one of the things that I hate to see when I go see a gig and I see guys on charts is, because, I mean, I like to connect to the music. I like to connect to the people. I like to connect not just to the music and the people, but to the players, and, like, communicate and have a dialogue and share that dialogue back and forth. And it's not really exciting to go see a show and the whole time you're looking at a player, like, all they're looking at is a sheet of music in front of them. You know, there's no connection there. It's just like, I'm here to play the show and that's it.
Get my check and go home. Yeah. See, I feel the same way, man. It's like, I can understand in a situation where the 30 songs on a weekend or whatever, and or even at church, you know, it's like, that's different. But when you go to see a concert or you pay to get in or whatever, you kind of expect, you know,
yeah,
the band to know the song or whatever. It is harder to like, I don't know, it just takes some of the luster off of it when you know that, I don't know, they're reading or whatever. But I find it incredibly difficult. I can write a chart fine and listen to the song and do that, but it's like you zoom in a little too close, you know, you'll miss the song by zooming in too close to the changes or whatever. Whereas, like, if I was just zoom out and listen to the song, your common sense, like your musical common sense, will tell you when the chorus is coming.
Yeah.
Or when the bridge or when it's going to the sixth or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, you can just kind of hear that stuff coming.
I think the more time you spend actually dedicating music to memory and learning it that way, the easier it is to learn and follow how song. I mean, true enough, music and the formula for music doesn't change too much. So if you're familiar with what that looks like, it's not difficult to follow a song at all.
Well, I agree, man. I love that part of it. Just, that's the part where you get to be a musician. When you get to, like, okay, here comes the bridge, and you don't hardly think about it.
I definitely think there's a human element to it as well. I sort of like to hear mistakes every mm-hmm. now and then. You know, it lets me know, like, at the end of the day, you know, you're not a perfect player. Now, true enough, I can say that I've heard perfect players that have hit a gig and not, without a chart in front of them, not missed a note.
Yeah.
And I still can't understand how that happens.
What's an example of a situation like that? Because I think, you know, anytime
I've seen some guys around town.
Around here?
Yeah.
I believe it, man. There's some talent around here.
Yeah, there's some talent around here.
Just a little bit. Jeez.
But, I mean, of course, being in Nashville, you've seen the exact opposite, where you do see the guys who, they don't move off the chart all night.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're in a studio session on stage.
Yeah, but even in the studio, man, I don't know. It's just so much easier to just groove and get in it when you don't have to be tied to it.
Yeah.
You know, but, yeah, I love what you said about guys that can come in, and it's like, how they do that? They play that gig just right.
Yeah.
You know, they're not perfect people, but they play that performance pretty close to the chest there.
And even if they did make a mistake,
we didn't notice it. Yeah, they probably thought they did.
Yeah.
But, tell me about, do you got any any favorite road stories that jump off your memory? I always like to talk about that with folks on here that have done that, because, you know, we get into the craziest.
Let's think of some crazy road
stories. Scenarios out there. At 1 in the morning, my brother got left. I tell you about that. I told you about that.
Yeah, I know about that.
He got left.
Forgot Bruno, about the merch guy.
Bruno, they left the merch man.
They left the merch guy.
He made about 40% of what they made on the gig on merch, and they left him. He's got their money. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, they still got the guarantee.
I know they got that part.
They got the guarantee. They just didn't have the overhead of like. Mm-mm. None money taken out of merch money.
Oh man!
But the thing is, with that kind of artist, merch fees, they still don't see all of that. Yeah, which is the interesting part of
merch fees kind of make me mad.
Knowing how merch works.
Yeah, you could, because you've done a lot of merch on the road.
Yeah, merch, stage crew, the Bunkwiki tour. We actually set up the LED wall and everything, so we were the crew.
Oh, gosh,
yeah.
That sounds like work.
Seen a couple of different sides of the worlds.
That sounds like work, dude. Hanging up lights.
Oh, it was crazy because on that tour, the only crew that we traveled with was our lighting engineer and our production manager, front of house guy. So every city we would sort of push to have like at least 8 hands.
Okay.
But myself, Brian, our drummer, and Lance were pretty much the crew. Like, every morning, wake up, because they were union hands, so they couldn't unload the trailer. So we would be on the trailer, unloading the trailer.
Wow.
We would pull it out, and then we would have to physically, like, guide them through, like, okay, this is how the LED wall is set up. And a lot of times, at that point, you're doing it.
Yeah.
Then we would have to set up, like, there were, like, 6. This tour was a little bit easier. Last year, we were doing a lot more. But there were, like, 6 12-foot lighting truss that would have to go up every day. And then once we were finished setting up all the production, then we would have to set up our own backline and then go do lunch and then come in and do like 3 hours worth of like just sound check and rehearsal to make sure everybody was good between the dancers and Angela, and like rehearsing both sets, because we were rehearsing Group One crew set and then rehearsing Angela Johnson's or Bunkwiki set. So long days.
Wow.
And that
man.
Tour came right after Toby's tour, which was the exact opposite.
You were just chilling.
Just chilling.
So that was like, okay, let me go over here in the corner.
But thing is, me and Brian, our drummer with Group One, he's on those rehearsals with me for these few weeks. And we were talking about it. And I don't think I'll ever be able to, I don't know if I ever want to get to a point to where I don't completely do anything at all. I think there's something very humbling that sort of keeps you grounded to be like, man, I got to break down my own stuff.
Yeah,
I got to put my bass in the case, and I've actually got to carry it to the bus.
So when you got through with Toby, you just walk off stage?
Yeah.
Wow. I ain't never.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I didn't have to change my strings on that tour.
Wow. Man, it was funny. My buddy Adam.
But he takes care of his people, and they've got such an amazing team that surrounds them. You know, I mean, big ups to Clint Harris, who is the best behind the scenes guy that I really know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's their backline tech. Every day Clint would set up all the staging for the instruments. He would sound check everybody's stuff. He wouldn't actually let me. I tried to change my strings and he was like, no, bro, that's what I'm here for. And I'm like, but I'm not doing anything. Like, I want to change my strings. No. What do you want on there? So it was definitely, I mean, it's a huge blessing. It was a huge blessing, you know. But like he said, that's what he was there for, and I sort of had to let him do his job.
Right.
And then the next tour was like, yep.
Let me pick up this lighting rig.
Let me pick up this lighting rig. Let me set up all my own gear.
Mm. See, that's so what's a day in life? Describe the two. So you already gave me like the day in life with the workload.
Yeah.
So what's a day in life with when you don't have no workload with Toby?
Wake up at 12 when lunch is being served.
Mm.
Now, honestly, a lot being on the road, I was still juggling work back at home. So I had my portable studio system out on the road. So I had tracks coming in out on the road, recording tracks, sending them back home between All Clear clients, trying to figure out how to adjust like the in-ear appointments and everything sort of like in the break time or when I came back off tour. So there was still, and there were a ton of clients that actually never even got to come in and have a meeting with me like you, because it was that thing of, well, you know, I'm out for 2.5 months, so let me get you everything in line and get you set up with audiologists and everything done so you can still be taken care of while I'm gone. So there was still a lot of work for me to do, but as far as that tour, really it was wake up, eat lunch, do everything else for home stuff, and then eat dinner, get dressed for the show, play the show, and that's it.
Wow, man.
So it definitely, the days definitely gave me a lot more room to just do whatever I wanted or needed to do, even if it was just, you know, hey, we're in a downtown area. And I think one of my favorite days, for a number of reasons looking back at it, but one of my favorite days was we played El Paso, Texas, and I actually had a workload, but I'm really into tea, specifically loose leaf, and I found like this small hole in the wall mom and pop's tea store called Tippy Tees, and I walked from the venue as hot as it was in that dry heat, which I was not thinking about, but I left the venue because of being around that many people all day. For one, you're living with 12 people constantly on a bus, and then you wake up and you go into a venue, and the personnel on, I think this tour was about 120 people. So there's not a day where you really aren't around somebody. And at home, I'm way more introverted. So, I mean, there'll be 2-3 days where I sit at home, don't want to reply to a text, don't want to answer a call. And I reset. And I've sort of tried to find that balance between being sociable, because with what we do, even if you're introverted, you have to learn how to step outside of that. But this was just one of those days where I was like, oh, there's a tea shop around the way. I grabbed my backpack, didn't say where I was going, didn't see nobody. I just left and sat at the tea shop for maybe 5-6 hours, set up my laptop, did my work, went back and got ready and played the show.
Wow. And it was like,
one of the best resets ever, just to break away and just go spend some time, you know, by myself, meditating, working, and just resetting.
No, dude, I totally feel you on that. Like, especially when you said, like, you know, even when you're extroverted, everybody has an introverted side.
Yeah.
And like, you need that, even if it's just, you know, an hour just where you're just staring off into your phone watching some stupid movie.
Yeah.
Or something on your own to just kind of, I don't know, like check out for a minute. Cause it can be, I mean, you can't be on all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it just gets to be too much. Well, that's cool, man. Well, this is my first time hearing about all that stuff. Cause I'd watched it all on like Instagram and stuff. I'm like, Oh dang, you got the Toby gig. That's what's up. Or Bruno might've told me one.
I mean, it's still hard to sort of go back and believe. And it was cool because I think I don't know what they're going to do with everything, but I mean, they actually had a live crew come out and record one of the shows. And so, you know, hopefully that stuff surfaces. I can have some tangible proof, a little souvenir. Yeah,
that'd be a good business. That'd be good for business, wouldn't
it? Have a good souvenir. And I mean, there was a lot of wisdom that I was able to take from all the guys. You know, it's one thing to be on several tours with them, and, you know, living on a bus with somebody is completely different from just doing a tour with somebody. You know, we've done several tours. We wake up, we end up in the venue together, we hang out. So there's already been sort of that family dynamic. But when you live on a bus with somebody that close in proximity, you get a lot closer to people. And there was a ton that I was able to take away just from plenty of nights where it was literally just me and Toby sitting in the front lounge, last two up, just having conversations, you know, just a lot of wisdom. And then it was weird too, because most of the bands that I've been in over the last few years, next to the artist being the oldest, I find myself next in that ladder. So it felt really weird to be like, man, I'm like the young kid in the group, you know. Yeah, wow. 31 being young.
Of course.
You know.
Well, 27 is still young, so that's all I know.
Are you 27?
Yeah. 27.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'll be My birthday is in April.
And Bruno's younger than you.
Yeah. He's 25.
Wow.
But we're like, we're vets, man. We've been at it since, you know, he was 16 years old or something.
Yeah.
So we know it. We know it like you guys.
Just yeah.
Been doing it our whole life. And the Vespers, Phoebe was 16 when you know, we first went out and had a record
me,
out.
You just sort of made me feel old.
No. You just said you were the young boy on Toby's
I know,
bus.
Man, but then you say your age, and I'm like, wow.
Yeah. But that's just, that's why, you know, I need you to be a little bit older than me because I see everything you're doing. So I got to give myself an excuse,
you
Mike.
You see what I'm doing, and I'm still sitting here like, man, I'm not doing enough.
Well, yeah, that's how, is that how, yeah. let me next question. Like, now, so having done all these things like you've done in major, or like, do you still feel that way? Like that whole wolf scratching at the door thing? Of,
I do.
Yeah.
I think for me, there's just, I don't ever really see myself finding myself content with where I am. I always feel like there's something bigger or better that I could be doing. As far as like this, and that's the thing, like to do the Toby gig, having toured and done the CCM thing since I've moved here, for me, it was almost like I've literally hit the top of what the CCM market looks like. And that was just filling in on a gig. So it's like everything that I do, you know, not speaking badly, but everything I do from there, staying in the CCM realm is like, oh, I'm taking a step back. So for me, it's almost like, man, I almost have to try to figure out if there's something mainstream to move past this. Like, what's the next accomplishment? What's the next goal? What else can I do to go to that next level of, like, pushing myself even bigger, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you know, that's part of the motivation.
Yeah.
That's just part of how we're wired up, you know? It's what keeps us driven. And
I think that's a lot of the reason why I step outside of not just being the player, but, you know, why through the sponsorship of a company like All Clear, why I wanted to be a little more involved and learn the business side and become a rep or just the little things like that, learning the business side, working more as a musical director with a lot of the indie artists in town, trying to learn how to do more of the management side and working with them in that capacity. So always trying to find sort of something else, because the reality is, and it's our dad has really told us a lot, you know, just growing up. And one of the biggest things that he said, too, is it's to really make the music thing work full time. It's hard to make it work and just be a player. Like, you have to, and you probably, especially being in Nashville, where you've got guys that do 17 mm-hmm. things. I know at least off the top of my head, thinking on one hand, several guys that play 3, 4, 5 instruments.
Sure.
You know, so there's always that thing of, man, there's somebody who's a little more capable to take my gig because they can offer more. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that was one of the things, too, that challenged me, even as a bassist. I think the first time that I really, really started to see, like, a challenge is Black Eyed Peas came in town. I didn't get to go to their concert, but they did a concert here, and I knew a couple of people that went, and they were like, man, they didn't even have a bass player. Like, they literally had a keyboard player, like, and he did key bass all night. And the first thing that clicked in my mind, job security, was
right.
I can't lose my gig to a keyboard player because right. they play key bass.
Right? How mad would you be?
So I think that was, honestly, in the last few years, I've actually gotten the desire to go back to where I was as a kid and try to get back into piano. And, you know, it made me buy a key bass. So now I don't think there's, like, any gig where I'm like, oh, you need key bass too?
I got that.
I got you.
Yeah.
Oh, you need... And when I moved here, we grew up and we used to do some singing and all of that. And my dad always said, you know, you want to have more to offer because it makes you more of an asset. It makes you more in demand. You know, people will call you more if they know you can do more than one thing. So when I moved here, I wanted to go back to, like, learning how to sing, which is why I do, like, a lot of BGVs on some of the stuff I do now. And that was probably one of the toughest things to, like, develop because the bass does everything opposite of the melody. So to try to sing and play like what you're playing is like a splitting of the brain, like yeah. right down the middle, which is why some of my favorite artists to this day, I still don't understand how some of them do it, but Sting, mm-hmm. amazing bass player, vocalist, which is you really don't see him play bass anymore. No. You know, when he does a lot of his stuff now, he's got full band behind him, and he's just the artist.
He's still got that old, is it that old Fender bass or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
Dude, man.
You got Paul McCartney, who people, it's funny, I was talking to somebody, and they didn't even know he played bass, because as an artist, he doesn't do it.
Right.
But, I mean, when you listen to, like, the old Beatles stuff, and I've tried to play some of those bass lines and sing, and I'm just like, what in
Dude,
the world?
It's next level.
And he, even next level than that, you've got Esperanza Spalding, who's on a whole nother level of, you're just two different people in the same body playing upright bass and singing, because some of the stuff she sings just makes no sense with what she's playing. So it's, in a sense, I almost had to relearn how to play bass while picking back up the skill to, like, sing. It was like, oh, everything I know about bass just went out the door. I have to recreate everything that I thought I knew. But at least at this point, I can confidently say, you know, I've sort of jumped that hurdle of being able to offer that, and then the challenge of key bass, and I'm still, the key bass is to me a little more solid. As far as piano, I've been spending a lot more time there, and I'm trying to figure out what the next goal is. Actually, I've got both of my guitars still at home, and I've been trying to debate pulling those out the closet and get my fingers back on those.
Like acoustic guitar or what?
I've got the very first miniature scale guitar.
Oh,
I told
my
you
gosh.
About, which they used to laugh at me because it was like this little red guitar with a black pick guard, real thin body. And the name of the guitar, it was three letters, CMI, guitar. So they used to joke, and they used to be like, man, that's your C my guitar. So I've still got that. And playing the guitar, it's funny because I was always given the first, like even with the bass, I was given the first, and then my parents got me the second. So I've got like a Fender Strat sitting in my closet, and I've got like a Ovation acoustic. So
okay,
I don't get rid of gear.
No,
you can call me a hoarder, but I don't get rid of
man,
gear.
Man, dude, I've had to sell so much of it.
And that stuff still like somehow finds its way out of my closet.
Well, good,
and, man. And gets used.
Well, you brought the story home by bringing it back.
Yeah.
You know. Well, what's next for you, dog?
Next, for the last 3 years, of course, I've been doing the Group One Crew, touring with Group One Crew. We just had an album release Tuesday last week. So, of course, you know, just seeing where that album takes Group One. Working with a couple of the local artists and seeing sort of where that goes. It's hard for me to really get stuck in one place because I like the challenge of not necessarily doing the same thing all the time. Even if I found a really, really good steady gig, I think I would still stretch myself to jump into other scenarios, because I think that's what helps keep me as a musician sharp, to be like, oh, today I've got to go play this pop gig where, you know, the structure doesn't move, what you play is the same. And then tomorrow I got to go play with this like funk group where it's like, hey, man, just play what you feel, but make sure you play the song, you know. And then it's like, oh, go play with this rock group where you play the same note or, you know, three notes in the entire. So I like the challenge to be able to wear the different hats. And it's hard to really say what's next. Part of why it's hard is because everything for me summed up for Nashville has been a faith journey. And part of that story, and this is doubling back to moving here, is I spent most of 2009 doing the back and forth all summer, practicing and playing with the band. And literally the last week of July, it was probably one of the scariest moments of my life, because I feel like as clear as day driving back home at night, I heard God say, go. And August in the same sentence. And in my mind, I'm like, I've lived with my parents for 24 years just doing the college thing. And, you know, and earlier that year, me and my brother lived together from like February up until that point. So I've never known what it was like to not be around family. And our family is really tight-knit. And to be driving home and hear, go, August, with 2 days left in July, was like, that's next week.
Mm.
And just in the process of that journey, there was a lot of other stuff going on, and I just had a lot of strong people, you know, prayer warriors, and just like really strong Bible grounded people just sort of pushing and reminding me of just sort of Abraham's walk and a lot of these other amazing men in the Bible. And, you know, it really built me up to be like, man, let me go. And it was crazy because I was playing at a church. We had two locations, and I went to the pastor, let him know sort of everything that was going on. And he just asked for just for me to give him enough time to get somebody else in position. And as clear as day, I remember throwing the very first bass rig my parents bought in my car, as many clothes as I could in one bass, back of my car, jumped in it, hit the road, and pulled into town the night of August 31st.
Mm.
And I remember being like, well, you said August.
It's August.
It's August.
Just barely.
It may be the end of August. But it was just crazy because, like we just talked about, to look back 7 years ago, I would have never been like, oh, I'll be able to hit the road with Toby, or I'll be able to go see part of the world, you know, having a chance to go to Australia twice, Africa twice, Europe. I mean, I wish I had the passport my brother has. I mean, I'm sort of jealous. He's been a lot of places. But that's because we also sort of divide and conquer. I guess that's what you can say. Well, we still get to come back together every now and then.
Yeah, you guys are making waves and doing it the right way.
But it's hard to really say I know what's next because I've sort of, since I've been here, when I first moved here, I had people like, man, Nashville is a tough city to break. It generally takes 3-4 years to try to figure it out. Within the first 2 months, me and my brother were out touring with B, you know. And then from then on out, it's just been this ongoing climb up this, like, huge mountain. So for me, it's hard to be like, oh, you know, I've really got a plan or know what's next. For me, one of the biggest things that I've always tried to keep in mind is, and it's sort of, I guess you can say, I don't think I've ever seen this quote anywhere before, so I sort of take it as my own, but I always say preparation meets opportunity. Opportunity won't come if you're not prepared for it. And even if it does come, if you're not prepared for it, you won't be able to take advantage of it. So I try to, in most of my time not knowing what's next, just spend that time preparing. You know, whether it be, like I said, training up my skill of, like, singing and playing bass, or like, oh, let me learn key bass. I'm not using it now, but I may have to use it at some point. And I think just in that preparation, just in God honoring sort of me spending time investing in my craft and bettering myself, the opportunities have come. You know, it's really, I can't say most of the opportunities that I've had since being in Nashville, I've went after or sought more than they've found me.
Well, that's good stuff, man. Well, I appreciate all your insight, and I know I'm, for one, I really look up to you guys, and, you know, appreciate who you are as men first and foremost, and obviously as musicians too. So thank you both for, you know, letting me into y'all's family and just hanging out. And to me, it's sitting under the learning tree, man.
Yeah,
you know, because you guys are doing what I want to be doing in my life, you know, and trying to get there.
Man,
so
you got it, man. You better be out on the road at the end
of
this
month. Yeah, man. It's good.
Playing with a string section from what I hear.
Yeah, it's going to be nutty. We're excited about it. I was really happy.
I got to buy you a GoPro and record it so I can look at it later.
You know what? No, seriously. I almost bought... Wendell had a camera that, like, what was it? Like this thing. Like a Zoom H something with that video. And I was going to get that off him, but I couldn't get the money in time.
You know what? Honestly, before I got this GoPro, this tripod that I've got is actually an iPhone tripod.
Really?
And the camera on your iPhone is at 1080. It's, you can set up your iPhone and
for
record
real?
That stuff.
See, because like my only thing is the sound of it. I don't know.
The
like,
sound on iPhone is actually really amazing.
Really?
Yeah.
So what do you do with it? So
for me, I don't know. I record everything just to have.
Yeah. See, that's smart. You're going to make
a
whole
documentary.
I go back and
look at it. Well, it's that. And for me, it's memories too. Like, okay. I've got so many videos of like the first tour we did with B, of like us just acting goofy just out on the road. Stuff that you can't really like go back and like be like, man, you remember that? Like the other day, I was going through like a ton of videos, and when we did rehearsal with B, we started talking about it. I was like, me and my brother were like, B, man, you got to see these videos we were looking at. Like, we forgot about all this stuff, you know. So it's just, it's like a library of just good memories, yeah, fun man. Times. You got to start recording some stuff, man.
Yeah, I'm gonna seriously consider getting one of those before that, because I do need to record what I'm doing and play it back, but also it'd be good for whatever social media purposes as well.
Honestly, half of what I got has never seen social media.
Yeah, I'm sure you got so much stuff.
Yeah, I love it, and it's too that thing of I've gone back and watched performances to like learn what to do better.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
you know it's almost like being on a sports team and like the coach recording the game and then coming back and be like, this is where you messed up. Go fix it.
Yeah.
You know, you always have to go back and revisit the play so you can know how to improve and come back later with a better plan.
If we can see the problem, we can fix the problem.
Exactly.
Well, this has been awesome. I really appreciate you coming by after a long day.
Is this where you put your music track on the...
Oh, dude.
I hadn't heard your podcast yet, so I don't know
my
if it's a music track that plays
is,
right here.
My podcast is Woodbine approved. This sucker goes in just as is. I don't mix or nothing.
I don't mix or nothing. I'm like, is this the point where I'm talking too much and like the music is playing in the background?
Credits are going
on. The credits are going.
The advertisers are making an appearance. No, this thing right here is what you see is what you get.
The awards music. Like.
No, bro. We just we sign off and that's it. So anyway, thank y'all for listening. If you like what you hear, follow Mr. Snoopy Clark on all the social media stuff that you can get. He obviously GoPros everything, so it's easy to follow his life.
Yeah, what's sad is the GoPro just went dead as you were closing out.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it's dead. We don't have it all.
It's all right. We got almost all of it.
Yeah, we are. We were talking for a long time.
We were about an hour and 4 minutes probably, something like that. So follow him on Instagram and Twitter and Snap and all those other things that you can follow him on.
I'll send you everything so you can put it in.
There you go. Plug it up. We'll plug it up on the description page. Brother, I appreciate it. Thank
you, bro.
Again. Yeah, man.
This was a good time.
Love you. Thank you for everything, for hooking me up with in-ears. Praise the Lord. They get a lot of use. So, all right. For Mr. Snoopy Clark, I'm Taylor Jones. We will see y'all next time.